Good morning and welcome to the NZ Funds Monday call. I'm Stefan Clark, Chief Client Officer, together with James Gregor, Chief Investment Officer. As she herself says, Teresa Gatting is probably better known for her commercial endeavors than her charitable ones. After being CEO of Telecom, co-founding My Food Bank, and chairing AIA New Zealand, among other roles. But philanthropy has been important to her from the beginning of her career, and today her commercial and social interests are coming firmly together. With her sister Angela, a leader in the field of education, former principal, advisor, and consultant in New Zealand and abroad, the two sisters have created the Gatting Foundation with a vision to empower the less advantaged, lift women out of situations of inequality, hardship, or violence, support young women, Māori and Pacifica, into leadership, and lift animals into better lives. Today, we will discuss with Teresa and Angela the Gatting Foundation, philanthropy in New Zealand, and leadership in driving positive change in business and beyond. Welcome. Thank you both so much for joining us. It's really exciting to have you here. I thought we'd start with a little bit of background on the Gatting Foundation and how you two came together to start it and move it to where it is now.
Well, I think actually the start point is our childhood. We were both brought up Catholic. I'm now a retired Catholic. But that philosophy that giving back is important has always been part of our DNA, my DNA, and Angela can speak for herself, but her DNA too. And although I spent many decades busy in a corporate career and I didn't have very much time, I actually, from my first paycheck when I got a full-time job back in my early 20s, donated to causes dear to my heart. So I had a monthly donation going to Amnesty International, Women's Refuge, New Horizons for getting women back into the workforce, and SPCA. And I give still to all those causes. So women and animals have always been and girls who didn't have the opportunities I did have always been a thing. So for I guess 30 years, I worked really hard and I just gave money to those things. And then when I left Telecom, I spent a long time working with the SPCA, creating a new, a huge, turning the old hospital into an animal hospital. It was a fantastic project, and ended up chairing the board and then going on the national board. And so that got me looking at it on a bigger scale, what might be possible if you put labor, energy, skills, volunteers together with money. And then I started supporting Angela in Kōtiritiri Ki Papakura, and I realized during lockdown that we had one plus one equals five, and indeed that is how it's turning out. So that's my story, and Angela, over to you.
Oh, kia ora. Thank you for inviting us on the show this morning. Yes, I think my whole life has been in the social and the giving sector, in terms that I didn't go the business route. I wanted to actually, it was my family that said you'd make a good teacher when I was a teenager, and I said, oh no, I can't do what my mum thinks I would be good at. But anyway, yes, I did.
Mothers are always right in
Yeah,
the
that's right. Parents know you very well, but you don't want to think that they know you that well. And so I worked, in the public education system in New Zealand, in a number of schools, and that was really rewarding. Of course, then I became a school leader and eventually went overseas and helped in other systems. And I came back to a different New Zealand, but one that was still showing huge inequities in, places in New Zealand. And I had purchased a house in Auckland while I was away. So when I came back to New Zealand, I lived in Auckland for the first time in my life, and I could see the disparity. Teresa and I had been raised in sort of small cities. We were raised in Rotorua. It was probably about a 30-40% Māori population. So when I came to Auckland and I found that there were some pockets of, real poverty, and especially South Auckland where I lived, I thought I'd really like to work in this area and use my skills and my knowledge and experience in education. And I was in the right place at the right time to be employed as, first of all, the education program leader at Kotuitui Ki Papakura, but the first employee, and then build the charity for the trust board that that had been established. And that was a really cool experience and one that I enjoyed immensely. Teresa came knocking on the door, "What about the Gadding Foundation?" And I said, "Go away, I'm busy and I'm happy and I'm doing, making a difference and I'm building a, you know, a charitable organisation." And then along came COVID, and after a couple of years, I was so exhausted and I was ready for a new start. So that's when we decided to join together and begin at the end of, towards the end of 2021.
I'm sure she can be very persuasive.
Yes, so but as I'm a sister, I can say go away, you know, like I know that she'll still love me even if I say no.
Very good. And so you came together and have been working on, I guess, five areas, are focus areas. So I'll just rattle them off, but I'd love you to talk us through them and how you landed on them and what they mean to you. So we've got At the Table, which is reducing inequality by lifting women, Māori and Pacific voices. Here Together, giving stronger families or growing stronger families with supportive communities. Cycle Breakers, relieving and reversing poverty cycles through grassroots support. Forging Futures, which focuses on education and learning opportunities, and Furry Friends, which comes back to that animal welfare piece. How did you shape those five focus areas? And then how do you, you know, use the platform you've got to advance them?
Yeah. So I'll get Andrew to speak to some of the programs running each of the areas. But first of all, dialogue. It had to work for both of us. Like, and I think it's important to understand that the Gadding Foundation, our logo, says the heart effect. We actually do have these strands, but it's not to say that everything that comes forward in those strands we're going to do, and it's not to say that we want to occasionally do things that don't comfortably fit in the strand. It's like it's got to touch us at a heart level. It's something that we think we can make a difference to and that we care about. The other thing that I believe is important is I used to think only big things matter, but actually In my last sort of decade, 15 years, I've come to understand that sometimes small things can really make a difference too. What I mean by that, like my first charitable thing that I worked on was bringing together the 37 SPCAs into one national organisation. It was a three-year project. It was a big thing. It had consultants. It was huge. And it was successful. If that hadn't happened prior to COVID, a lot of animals in New Zealand, those smaller shelters were already losing money. It would have been a disaster. So it was a good project and it worked. But small things can make a difference too. And I really admire, she was Mackenzie Bezos, now Mackenzie Scott, her approach. Because what I have observed, a little bit in New Zealand with some of the bigger foundations and a lot in the US, because I also support charitable works globally. I'm on the International Board of World Pulse and I give money to international charities as well. And what I observed, particularly in the US, is that there's now a caution around giving in institutions, and you can take 11 meetings with an organisation before they'll give you a grant, and it's all very risk averse, it's all very corporate, and even in New Zealand, you know, some of the original families that set up foundations have turned it over to professional managers. It might be a heart thing for them, but it's also a job, and you can get knocked out before you even, you know, get to talk to the principal. So Andrew and I deliberately wanted something that was very immediate, that Andrew would do the due diligence, we would assess, make decisions quickly, we'd make it easy for people to, for us to be accessible, we'd make it really easy. So there's a little bit about the how that is different from us, for us. We wanted to keep, sometimes $2,000 can make a huge difference to something, sometimes you need to spend 20 for it to, you know, be meaningful. And so our projects have been between $2,000 and $250,000. It depends what it is. And sometimes things build. But we're always open to ideas that come along that touch our heart and we go, we just can't not do this. So now I'll get Andrew to talk to some of the programs in each of the strands.
Oh, thank you. Just to go back a little bit, how did we land on those five was your question. And it was about workshops with the three trustees and the company that helped us form our brand. And it was really clear that that Teresa has had a feminist sort of history, a history of supporting women in entrepreneurial pursuits. You know, the Auckland University entrepreneurship program for women, and CEO, which is now Coralis. So it was really clear that we were going to have a female focus. We come from a family of four girls. We were raised in the time. The slogan was "Girls can do everything." Somehow that's got lost, and for particular, you know, sections of the female society in New Zealand, the Māori woman and the Pacifica woman, you know, that we wanted to help them find their feet and get them around the table. And the actual phrases were just created through discussion and talking, and what do we like, what do we not like, you know, how does it express the flavour that we're trying to share about, you know, where we want to work and how we want to work with organisations. So that's where they came from. You know, Fairy Friends has actually become Furry and Feathered Friends, because, you know, there are some bird organisations and we never thought about that. And this morning my husband said to me, "What about fish? Are you a furry?"
Next will be insects.
Yeah, not sure, because, you know, so we're open to, as Teresa said, what it is that touches us. And we are supporting different types of organisations in each of those strands. Would you like me to carry on now to explain a couple of
them? Yeah, that would be great. Yes, very much so.
Okay. So we really want to support girls in education, and we are keen on STEM, and we're also keen on projects that might have, that do have a sort of effect through a learning, you know, pipeline from primary, secondary, tertiary or training, and then internship or work experience and employment. And that is the key to link the opportunities for young girls through their, you know, their early life into what's their first job, or are they going to be a young entrepreneur, whatever, if that's the case, if they want to do that.
Angela, so, can I interrupt you on that? I totally coincidentally, my sister lives in the UK and she's a chemical engineer that went to university at Canterbury, and in her class she was the only woman. And it just so the reason I was talking to her about this particular topic was on national radio this morning. They were talking about the lack of engineers, and they were going on about lack of tradespeople courses or something. And she goes, "All of that is, we're quite frank with each other, BS." And she said, "If you want to increase the number of engineers in New Zealand or globally, you need to get women, half the population aren't training as engineers." And she said, "The whole problem isn't at university," which it is. The whole problem is even the education around mathematics and physics and all these subjects, and the way they teach women is just totally wrong. And she said it was done in a way that was all aimed at men and boys and how they learn, and not for, and so all of a sudden for women, maths isn't as cool. And so somehow other subjects you've got law firms now that have more women than men in their junior ranks, at least. And I think we've still got an issue at the leadership level. But how do you even, I mean, these are such big structural issues in the education system. How do you, it must be overwhelming sitting there and thinking how we're going to make these changes to really make a significant change. How, when you put together some of these programs, you know, how, is it one step at a time? Is it aspirational change? What do you think about?
I think it's working at all different levels when you get the opportunity. You know, I can see that Teresa's got some thoughts that she wants to share.
Well, Angela can talk to the program she was working on in terms of teacher at the teacher level, in terms of training, what needs to happen. But going back earlier than that, it starts before university. I mean, by the time I went to university, I was already going to be successful. I'd been ducks. I'd come from a happy family. Book learning was important. I read a book a week, etc. Starts before that. So we're like, two of the programs we've got at the moment, one of them is working in South Auckland, and it's like a recovery program. It's taking some of the girls who got lost in COVID. They didn't go on to education, and they left school, and they lost 2 years of schooling. It's like trying to recover them with mentors and get them going again. It's like we've got to use our human capital. Now, on the other side, there are plenty of girls who are bright enough, but they've got to be channeled. And so the Gally Foundation have been supporting girls' robotics, the Kura on the East Coast, to do robotics. It's all STEM, and come to Auckland and compete. And that's just taking off. It's a collab on the East Coast. And it's like, you just imagine if you're a poor Māori girl in one of those schools, you're never going to end up as an engineer unless you get a boost in some way and you actually get into believing, to your point, that maths is cool. Well, maths is cool if you're winning robotics competitions. You know, it's like you've got to actually go with where the energy is. And in my day, robotics wasn't a thing, but it's going to be more and more of a thing. I can't pick up anything now without reading about it. So it's actually, we look for where the energy is and where we can accelerate that energy. And as Angela said, we work at all different levels. And then other people apply their intelligence. Last year, we ran several programs with young girls, last year of school, started out in South Auckland, but ended up West Auckland, rural Auckland as well. And we brought them in for a day. We did it with another organisation, and it was about raising their sights. And I talked to one of the teachers who'd come with one of the group of girls, and she said, you know, she said, they were all Māori and Pacifica. And she said, we didn't bring the ones that would have made it anyway. We didn't bring the ones who are going to be ducks, head girl, et cetera. We bought the next group who've got potential, but their family situation is a bit difficult or they lack confidence, and they would find these days life-changing. But the ones who are going to make it were going to make it anyway. And so it's, you know, it's always we apply our best efforts with the organisations we work with and then try and create change at the individual level, because that is where it starts. But over time, this will turn into bigger and bigger waves. And we've only been going, Angela said, we actually got the trust set up late last year, but we've only been really going a year. And so we're learning a lot as we go. So before I hand it up to Angela, I just want to say the trust is tax deductible. So we've set it up in such a way that other people can donate as well, tax effectively. And we are very much wanting to work with other foundations. We already work with lots of partner organisations and delivering programs and creating programs. Angela spends a lot of her mahi doing that. But we don't want to just be, you know, she spent a lot of time networking. We don't want to just do it the way we see it. The only thing is that we do tend to support women and girls. And I was challenged on that. I've been challenged on that quite a bit. And someone said, well, what about the boys? And I said, well, look, find a male philanthropist. You know, my heart is in supporting women and girls.
Well, I mean, if there's room for everybody to get in and help. And it just sounds, to summarize that, and people use this word, or it's a bit of a throwaway word, but it is truly grassroots. You really do have to start at the individual to properly make a difference. And that's why these things are such monumental change that is needed to really make improvements in lots of people's lives.
Mm. So we tend to have a sort of a relational community approach. So we don't go to an organisation expecting to know what the answers are for them. I know that, and I've worked in communities where they actually have the answers. They just don't have the connections, the resources, the knowledge of the how. So I tend to like to support partners that I work with. It's not just, you know, sending a donation across. So there's a real relationship, there's a real sort of exchange of ideas and assistance in terms of my time and my expertise. And I work very comfortably in the education space. And yes, it does start at primary level. So in our last year, I reached out to an organization and I said that I'd like to support we'd like to support an isolated school with girls who would like to learn robotics. And we found, we were connected with this kura on the East Coast, as Teresa mentioned, and they were equipped with the equipment from our donation, and then they went to Lower Hutt for the national championships, and they won the judges award. But the cool thing is that these girls are taught in te reo Māori in their kura. and they were able to compete in Te Reo Māori. And so then my thinking with the school was, this is all really good, but what support do you have in your region? You know, so you have to travel a long distance to learn and to, they do scrimmages is what it's called, the regional competitions. And so then when I connected with a kaupapa Māori organisation working in Te Raiwhiti, Gisborne, I said, are there other kura with other girls in that kura, in those kura that would like to, you know, work together, the teachers work together to learn and the girls be equipped with this robotics equipment, and they could learn together, they could have their regional competitions. They're still travelling because that coast is, you know, as we know, it's a long coast and the roads are really poor. So this is where I said to the collab, go back, talk to your community and, you know, come back to me when you got, you know, your ideas about what it is that would really lift girls in the region. And so that's where this project, which will now include this year up to 10 new schools, has come from. And it hasn't got a name yet. I'm waiting for the community to give the name to this project. And then last week I had a meeting with with another foundation that works in the from high school to university space with scholarships and mentoring and paid, you know, internships. And he said, I would love in the future to connect our program with this program for the girls that have come through those Kohini robotics programs. So it's like, yeah, stuff will sort of like
be almost snowballs
and a bit of a push and then off it goes.
And then off it goes. It's not like we've come along determining what it is that we want to do. It's about the communities and relationships with our partners seeing need and designing as we go.
One of my questions was, which just on this, was Teresa, you've been quoted saying there's too much saviourism and that groups and communities know what they need. They just need to be supported to make it happen. And I guess this is it, right, as you put the trust in.
Angela has just said it so articulately. From a feminist perspective, you know, I am not in the woman should learn to lean in school. I'm in the fix the system, not the woman, which is, you know, it's like, so, but Angela just was expressed beautifully what that is. I cringe occasionally when I hear Wilmington Pākehā say something and I think, gosh, you know, I won't name names here, but I'll just give you an example. I was at a gathering about 2 years ago, nearly all Pākehā woman, but the guest speaker was a very well-known, very high-profile, very high mana Māori woman. And she was a Pākehā woman about my age, stood up and said, oh, how can we get more Māori women into our organisation? And this guest speaker, with great dignity, and she said, well, it's not really about getting Māori women into your organisation, it's about us walking together. And that's the thing, you see. It's like the dominant culture, whether it's a male culture or the white culture, expects everyone else to, you know, want to join. But actually, that's not how we're going to create a great Aotearoa New Zealand. It's not how we're going to create a great country. And so Andrew and I work from big to small. Think about the animal strand, honestly. I mean, it depends. We went to the SPCA, we said, what is your area of greatest need? They said, we need a truck for the far north, because the far north is huge distances. There's horses, there's dogs, there's everything up there, and our truck's basically way out of life. And so we respond to, now that case doesn't require work, that just requires money. But look at the other animal things. There's everything from, as Angela mentioned, you know, the SPCA for birds, Birdcare Aotearoa, to animal, to rehabbing, you know, race horses, et cetera, to really groundbreaking, innovative stuff that can lead the world. There is a woman in Dunedin, and she has got she's training dogs to sniff out ovarian cancer, and it's working. Now, ovarian cancer is hard to detect. By the time a woman has got it, she's got it. It's usually a death sentence. And so, if dogs could sniff it out early, this is something that could be globally a huge deal. So we're surfacing all sorts of things, and that I've already started talking to some of my friends about. We'll have a fundraiser this year, might be for that. So it's like you can, we couldn't have gone looking for something like that. The intersection of health, I'm chair of TED, I'm interested in health and dogs. This woman in Dunedin came to us and it's like, wow, we'd really like to try and help you accelerate this. We won't be able to fund it all ourselves. Maybe we can't even fund anything of ourselves, but we can help be a catalyst to get funded with something that's incredibly innovative. And anyway, so I feel like I've rambled a bit.
What I take from that, and I'm still thinking about your comment earlier about some criticism around only focusing on women and girls, where by being successful and equaling the playing field for women and girls helps men and boys by design. I mean, it's, you want everybody in our society to be have an equal opportunity, and then a lot of the things that happen in society that we want to try and improve do fall away just by equal opportunity, and you therefore focus on people better, you know, by whatever their race or gender is, at a disadvantage. It just, to me, it's just such a no-brainer. And it's not saying that there's other people, white men, that aren't having a problem, but it's, yeah.
If all those businesses were funded at the level and extent that men's businesses are funded, we would get so much more GDP lift in New Zealand, we'd all be better off. But I do appreciate that if you're a white sort of 50-year-old man at the moment, this is not as easy a time to be walking around New Zealand looking for jobs or trying to get on boards, because you're competing with the whole population. And in fact, you're competing in some situations with organisations that really need, they need to up their te ao Māori game, or they need to, you know, get a gender balance of at least 40% women on the board, or be under investor pressure. So at an individual level, I think that it's not a particularly comfortable time to be a white man, but at a societal level, it's obvious that that a rising tide, if we would lift all boats, and we'd all be better off.
And so, Angela, with the robotics, you've obviously, the snowball is now moving forward. Where did you see that developing to? I think it's a great example of how I really like the word catalyst before. A little idea becomes something quite a bit bigger, and if you've got 10 schools now and they're going to be competing, do you see that developing further?
It could do, but I don't want to...
You don't want to drive it. You want to let it happen.
No, I don't want to drive it. I don't want to determine the future of it. I want the community to determine the future of it. Then there are so many possibilities. Of course, these CUDA, they do go right through to year 13, but maybe there's a place for, you know, the Gisborne Girls and Boys High School to somehow be involved, because, you know, they're not CUDA kaupapa, but they're in that region. Like, that's a possibility. Or we could go to a group of CUDA in another place of New Zealand and try a similar thing there, not the same, because context matters. Yeah, there are lots of possibilities. It's just, we're at the very beginning of this we started last year, the first year. We've got another 3-year commitment that we've made right now. The people over there are recovering from the cyclone. So the timelines, even in this first 6 months, are going to be relaxed a little to let that recovery happen. Because they can't even travel, like, in their region at the moment. So one step at a time, and I've learnt to be comfortable with that, learnt to be comfortable with letting time do its thing, not try and push something and rush something, but see how it develops and lend the expertise through the process, not have these preconceived ideas of the ideal future, because the people in the community need to create that.
I think you've just given sage advice to every single business owner, charity, foundation. I think I couldn't agree more, as I sit here thinking maybe I should just lay off my team a bit, let them work through the issues we're going through.
The idea of philanthropy generally, I mean, it's in New Zealand, it's a different model from, say, the States. And in the States, it's, you know, big institutional public. In New Zealand, it's more anonymous. It's not as much at that institutional level. You don't have these huge foundations providing effectively social services. How do you think about New Zealand philanthropy, and how do you see it developing, and why is it that Kiwis are so private?
Okay, so there's a few things. So first of all, New Zealand has a welfare state. I haven't lived in the US, but up until the pandemic, I'd been there every year for work or leisure or whatever. And, you know, they don't have a welfare state effectively. You know, just think about how difficult it was for Obama to get, you know, basic health care up for everyone. Whereas in New Zealand, anyone can rock up to, and call an ambulance and rock up to Auckland or Middlemore Hospital or whatever. Like it's a different model. And I think because there's a welfare state in New Zealand, some people go, well, it's the state's job to feed everyone and to do this and to educate everyone, etc. Whereas in the US, there isn't an underpinning, and there is a bit of a history of the wealthy giving back, and you've got the giving pledge. You know, Warren Buffett and Bill Gates giving half their wealth away during their life. I'm not aware of anyone in New Zealand who signed up to that. I mean, we haven't signed up to that. No, not that anyone's asked us, but some of the very wealthy Australian families, some of the billionaire families have signed up to that, but not many. But quite a few in America have. And so there's quite a history about that. On the other hand, New Zealanders are quite generous. I mean, for a crisis, that, you know, the money that's been given through both the Stuff Appeal and the NZ Media Herald Appeal in the last couple of weeks for cyclone damage, et cetera, is actually quite generous. So I think it's just emerging in New Zealand. I'm not particularly critical. I think that there's more happening now than there was previously. I believe that the heroes and heroines of our time are people who've been successful and then give back. I don't think we're living in a time in New Zealand or the world where people are admired who just make money and then build or buy gin palaces and, you know, swan off overseas. That people who give back through money and effort and networks and all of that, it's like that feels like the energy of the moment. So I think this is a bit of a momentum, and the natural disasters will just reinforce that. So again, I see around me a lot of people being generous, but on the anonymity thing, I think it's actually, unless what you're doing has a political overtone and you believe in something passionately, but you don't want to get caught in the crossfires of politics, which can easily happen in New Zealand, I've always been public about my donations. And I had this discussion with my best friend, Margaret Dukas, who sadly passed away a few years ago, because she was the one that got me into the SBCA. And she and I were the inaugural funders of the new Animal Care Centre. And she wanted to be anonymous, and I was happy to be public. And I said, Margaret, you will inspire people if you let your name. It's not like you're showing off. And so she did, and that's exactly what happened. And so I actually think, whether it's the arts or whether it's what we're doing, it's like, I think actually putting your name to it will inspire other people, and it make other people think, okay, well, what can I do? So I'm not a big believer in anonymity unless it's actually, you just want to avoid sort of being criticised, because you can get criticised whatever you do, and you know, people have their own stories and stuff, but on the whole, I think it's better to put your name to it because you can have more impact. It's as simple as that.
Leading from the front. I'm aware of a bunch of business people who are very generous as well, but they choose not to be public. So I think, just anecdotally, there's a shift that needs to happen or should happen if we want, you know, to develop that more in New Zealand and show it. You've both worked in different organisations at, you know, different levels of leadership as well. How do you think, now that you've set up the Gacking Foundation, how do you think about leading change? And is it different in your current organisation and what you're doing from the organisations you've led as principal, CEO, whatever it happened to be? It's obviously a different sector, but a lot of the skills would be similar.
Well, I think that as I've got older and grown and had more experience, I have become a different leader, I think. And that's just accumulation of learnings and knowledge. But there are some sort of fundamentals, like putting other people first, having time for your organisation, your people. I love the quote, you know, to me and Nui or te ao, what is the most important thing of the world, you know, he aha te me and Nui o te ao. he tangata, he tangata, te he tangata. And I always like try to be approachable as the leader. You know, my open door actually caused a lot of problems for me as a principal, but I tried to keep the door open. So I think that that's something that I've always tried to be, not sort of closeted away as the boss somewhere and you have to make an appointment to see me. I think that's really important to be working in the organisation. So as a principal, I was always a teacher. I had a class. I didn't like put myself in this job. I wanted to do what other people in my organisation were doing. And likewise at Kotuitui, you know, I was helping my people with various parts of the job. And I never got an operations manager so that I could be CEO. I didn't want that, you know. I wanted to be involved at the level of the employees and the volunteers. So Teresa's worked in much bigger leadership sort of scenarios where that probably not so possible, but I'm sure that she will talk from her expertise. I know that she had a huge leadership team, but she was very close to all of them. So I think that's, you know, the people aspect is also close to her heart.
Yeah, most of them are rocking up to my 60th birthday party next week. So awesome. That's pretty cool.
Happy birthday.
So I think that the most important thing about leadership is to understand that people are way more impacted by what you do than what you say. And it doesn't matter whether it's a charity, your own business, a corporate. It just doesn't matter whether you're the chair, the CEO, but particularly if you're the CEO. And I remember my head of HR joining me a couple of years into my time at Telecom. And she said she spent the first 6 months working with me, looking behind my back to see if what I said to her was different from what I said to other people, what I said. And she said it took her a while, but she concluded that there was no difference between what I said I would do and what I did do. And that's the thing, you see. You have to actually do it. It's doing it. It's not talking about it. And that, so I believe that we are doing something that will have much bigger impact. It's like bringing Kyoto, New Zealand, and all the things that have evolved for that, for women in business. It's like you just take the first step and then the next one presents itself, etc. Now, the prior question you asked, I didn't answer. I was mulling on that. And I think that we set this up believing that we might well do advocacy. To date, we haven't done advocacy. But I think Angela, we live across the road from the supermarket, and we're watching charities bring their trucks in, take away food waste to feed, you know, some of Auckland. So there are some obvious areas where it's not working. It's, charities are raising money, donations to feed people. I mean, that's just not the New Zealand we want. So that'll be a big conversation for us, you know, as to how much we decide to go into that advocacy space. But you've got to start by understanding, you've got to start by learning, you've got to start by knowing. And so that's, I guess, a servant model role of leadership, rather than assuming we know everything to start with. But Angela spent time working in some of those food recovery places in Auckland, and a lot of those were funded through COVID, and the funding stopped, but the need has not stopped. So there are some really big issues that I think that we will end up servicing. Domestic violence, I've always supported domestic violence charities, and you know, we support Pet Refuge. That I like things that are an intersection of what's important to us. So Pet Refuge is, if a lot of women, there's a demonstrated link between pet violence and domestic intimate partner violence. And Drew Chapman set up Pet Refuge to take dogs and cats so that women could leave violent situations who were trapped there because they were worried about their animals. And so, you know, we quite like things that are intersectional that way, that we can support two of our strands together. And there's a few of those things. Working with horses with damaged women, that's a, you know, that the whole horse whispering thing is real. It can be very effective for people who can't easily be reached in a linear talking head psychologist way. So I feel like I'm going around the mulberry bush a bit, but leadership essentially comes back to having such a strong inner conviction and a bias for action that you can inspire by being clear and then getting on with it, and then surrounding yourself with people who have sort of a like focus. They'll be attracted to you like a magnet. And making sure you bring people on board who can collaborate, because no one person ever has all the answers.
Absolutely. And I mean, obviously you took the role, I mean, you mentioned a telecom at, what was it, 37, is that right?
It's, yeah. And I got asked, same age as Jacinda, I got asked if I was going to have kids too. I didn't intend to have kids, but, you know, Bill English was the same age, as became treasurer at the same age that I became CEO of telecom. And he had many kids at that time, many kids, six kids. No one said, oh, you've got six kids. You know, do you think you can be a treasurer?
Yeah. How do you, I mean, how do you, you I mean, you'll have immense number of learnings, but how do you sort of think about that time then and then how it's different now? And obviously you're still involved in a number of business activities now.
Yeah. I'm chair of Global Women. And honestly, the passion and energy behind gender equality and leadership in New Zealand and embracing Te Ao Māori appropriately and building inclusive cultures that are about belonging, not just, you know, representation, is palpable. It's changed out of sight. It's really accelerated in the last 5 years. You know, I see Antonia Watson, CEO of ANZ, talking publicly about menopause. I went through menopause at Telecom quite early. I never would have mentioned it. The board and my team and the media would have been like, what? It's like, so in terms of bringing your real self and making it easier to live a complete life doing those sort of roles, it's got easier. Society has relaxed a bit about, you know, this. So many men now are taking paternity leave, well, parental leave, taking parental leave. There's just a bit more, and the pandemic's helped this probably, a bit more feeling that your job isn't everything. So I was stiffer in those days. I was more defended. There was personal subjects were completely off limits. And it's still harder to be a woman. There's still the penalties for failure are still higher. And it's still demonstrably harder to get your business funded if you're an all-woman team compared to a all-male team. That is indisputable.
Other than that last comment, which what I'm about to say doesn't relate to it, but the other things you said that that have got more relaxed, perhaps, does that make you optimistic about the changes and what therefore society can go through? Or is it still, you know, or is it, hang on, it's been 20 years and it's still bloody hard and, you know, we need to make better progress faster.
No, and we're coming off such a low base is another.
The Global Woman Hui, which is up in Te Tau Tokoro, the treaty grounds, in May, is a group of Pākehā women and Wahine Māori coming together to co-create, invent Aotearoa New Zealand 2040, which is 200 years since the treaty was signed and 150 years since women won the right to vote. And remember that the right to vote was given, legislated, for Māori women and Pākehā women on the same day. All around the world, Indigenous women didn't get the right to vote when wealthy white women got the right to vote. There's something about New Zealand that's inherently about give everyone a fair go. We're all in this together. We're small enough and we're big enough. And we are a beacon for the world. We're really well ahead on Indigenous rights when you look at the rest of the world. And I see some of the honest colleagues in Australia starting. I go to corporate things in Australia and they acknowledge the Indigenous people. Well, you know, that was the beginning 30, 40 years ago in New Zealand. That turned into treaty settlements, reparations, etc. That this is now turning into how do we take, you know, celebration around Matariki and how do we take the best of the Be a Good Ancestor, the Te Ao Māori World Lens Views, world view. Look at that as a lens for life. How do we take the best of that and what we want to celebrate about our culture and bring that together for this whenua and this moana and this place that we've all chosen to live? So I'm very optimistic because I think I'm part of shaping this in New Zealand through everything I'm doing. I'm surrounded by amazing wahine doing the same. And I'm very optimistic that we can do this for our country and in that we can continue to be a beacon for the world.
That's awesome. That I think in essence that creates positivity and optimism is contagious. And I think that's a really good thing if you've got leaders like yourselves spreading that type of optimistic thought process, then, you know, that does spread naturally.
And being brave about it. I mean, that's you're both obviously in developing the foundation and also in your careers have pushed very hard to be at the forefront of it and drive, you know, positive change. So, you know, it's exciting to see. It's probably a neat segue now. I had a question which is a little esoteric, but I'll give it to you anyway. What would you give an ambitious younger version of yourselves? What advice would you give them?
I think we both wanted to do things really quickly, early, and that's good because we had a lot of energy, you know. I'm a couple of years younger than Teresa, and when I was a teenager, and she, I could see that we could all see she was going to be different. Like, oh my goodness, she was a trailblazer. But you know, it's like I sort of adored her, and I watched it, and but I didn't choose it for myself. And I became a teacher, and my other sister was a social worker, and our third sister was an office administrator. We all took traditional paths, and Teresa like forged ahead and did something different. And wow, she's gone to live in Wellington. You know, it's like a big city. And so I think that it's okay what decisions you make. So it's fine, because if you're lucky enough to live a life, you know, a longish life, and now we're both, well, Teresa's just 60 and I'm in my late 50s, there's lots of opportunities to do things, and you can take those opportunities and you can envisage or aspire to what you want to do, and you've got a long path. So I would say to my younger self, it's okay, you don't have to go that way, you can go any way you choose, but keep looking for the paths of your choice. Like, don't, you know, be resilient, take a longer term view. Like, I rushed to be a school principal. I was 37 too, you know, of a co-ed school, secondary school. And it's like, I was 45 and I was thinking, what am I going to do next? Shall I just do this job for another 20 years? No, let's not do that. Let's, you know, like, where shall I go next? So, in a way, it's okay to take your time. I'm bringing this time thing back now. It's okay to take your time. If you want to rush, that's okay too. Just look after yourself in the process, because I think that my life hasn't been in the media spotlight like Teresa's. You know, I raised three children, and I had moved around a bit between jobs, and each time I had to sort of redefine what it was that I wanted to do and where I was going, and being in awe of my sister. You know, often I'd be introduced as Angela Gatting, but then the person would say, now Teresa, what do you think about this? So, like, and then, you know, we have a sister in Hamilton who was very heavily involved in herbal medicine. And a couple of times when I was actually introduced as Yvonne Gatting, I got a shock that it wasn't Teresa. It was like, yeah. And actually accepting that I'm part of this family, that's actually, we are a bit different. And why are we a bit different? And that's okay, because at the beginning, when I was a young adult, I didn't like to be associated with my sisters. But then as I got older, I actually liked it more. And now I really like it. So. Do change, and you do sort of see your life sort of like opening up rather than just on one track. But yeah, there are many ways you can go. So that would sort of be my advice to my younger self. Yeah.
So the first thing is, I want to acknowledge our wonderful father who died during lockdown. We were with him at the time. Had been with him all that period. He got one thing so stunningly right. It has everything you see. I mean, our mother's important in it too, but this bit is dad. Everything you see is, I think, comes from that. He had sisters, and he really respected his mother, who was very smart. He thought she was very smart. And he basically said to us, you have to be able to support yourself financially. You cannot rely on the state, and you cannot rely on a man. And that, you know, deep, you've got to be financially independent. You've got to get a good career. And we all sort of got that message. And for me, that was like just so profound that I wanted to create something that would mean that I'd never be dependent upon anybody else. And of course, one thing led to another. So, and then you have to love, you have to be successful, but you have to love and help other people. So my father was never just about financial security. It was always about loving and helping other people. And he was himself a very loving person. So that combination of being growing up with parents who really wanted us, you know, wanted would have had more kids if they could have done, but I think that's good. They stopped at four because there was only just enough resources for four. On the other hand, they were both quite, they were immigrants, and immigrants go, we've got to get on with it. And my advice to my younger self would be, you are right to be focused on a career and building financial security for you and your family. But actually, life's a very long time. It's a marathon, not a sprint. And I approach life as a sprint. I've burnt out twice, once in my mid-20s and once in my mid-50s. And so my advice to my younger self would be a bit like Angela's advice, which is, you know, it's great that you can be so focused and so determined, but you need, it's bread, life is bread and roses, and you need to make sure that you look after your physical body and you look after your, you know, you have enough joy in other parts of your life, because sometimes things are out of your control and just get, you know, things, you can just get knocked off your axis. I mean, my new house at the beach, I hadn't even moved into, but I've had a house there for 30 years. This is my new house, was the epicenter of the tornado 2 weeks ago. It's been, had the louvers blown off, the cedar damaged, hadn't even moved in. It was perfect. Literally on Friday, Neve, my wonderful guy who cleans the windows, left it looking perfect, and at 7:45 on Saturday, it got covered in shit, bark everywhere, salt on the windows, cedar at the front and back damaged, some of the roof blown off. It's like, what the hell? It's like, and you think you can control life. This was a tornado in Dillon Street, Waihee Beach.
I was going to say, of all the storms, a tornado.
Resilience, as Angela said, and just accepting that you can't control life, you can't control, you shouldn't control other people. You can't control events. And then the two things would be, in life, we get to play every part in the play. We end up playing every part in the play. There's enough time, and we usually end up playing every part in the play at some point, the hero and the villain. And there's always time to choose a new path, to get going again. And I think in everyone's life, two things will happen. They will at some stage be treated really unfairly. They'll be blamed for something personal publicly that they either didn't do, or it wasn't like that, or it just come out in a way that isn't fair. And actually how you deal with that and who stands by in that time is really important. And also they will be given opportunities and walk through a portal, or walk through a door and go, how the hell did this happen? You know, either I've met the love of my life and we're getting married, or my business has gone from, you know, it's gone from small to large in 3 years, and it's whatever. It's like, so it's embrace that, run with that. But in the words of the great Catholic saint that I was named after, Teresa of Avila, and my company is Avila Holdings, I actually have Catholic DNA, even though I don't do Catholic practices anymore, because the church is the biggest misogynistic thing you could imagine. This too will pass. So really enjoy the good times, because you don't know how long you've got them for, and don't get so daunted by the bad times that you can't say, well, tomorrow could be better, because some tomorrow will be better. So, yeah, that's it, really. Life's a marathon, not a sprint, and we get to play every part in the play.
Very cool. Thank you. That's fantastic. I think, James, did you have any other questions?
I've got about a thousand questions. I'm just trying to think of words to sort of sum up some of the things I've learned on our call, and I think... It feels like in for both of you, the places where you perhaps learned the most about yourselves and your experiences were in the tough times. When you said, Teresa, for example, when someone will say something bad about you, I remember it vividly on some of the blame. You were blamed for telecom re-regulation. I mean, I don't know what you had to do with that, but apparently, and it was an
achievement. It was your
fault. Blimey good achievement if you managed to cause that, considering you're not the government. But I mean, man, those sorts of events must be awful at the time. They are. We all go through a different type of that event, no matter what we're doing. But the coming through that, like you said, and this too shall pass. Look what you're doing now. I mean, you're an inspiration to everybody, and I think that's an amazing achievement. And then when I think about my kids who have just embarked on their journey at school, they've just started school. And I think if my kids got to be in the vicinity of someone like you, Angela, teaching them, we're in a pretty good position in New Zealand to have people like yourself teaching our children. So, well, this has been a pretty awesome hour learning about some of the leaders of our country. So thank you.
Thank you. If there's anyone out there, just go to our website and then you'll get Angela. And because we're happy to look at programs, co-create, take donations, take ideas, whatever.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time. Hopefully you'll hear from our audience.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Dan.
This has been The Monday Call, brought to you by NZ Funds. New Zealand Funds Management Limited is the issuer of the NZ Funds KiwiSaver Scheme, the NZ Funds Managed Superannuation Service, the NZ Funds Advised Portfolio Service, the NZ Funds Wealth Builder, and NZ Funds Income Generator. A product disclosure statement for each is available at nzfunds.co.nz. Past performance is not necessarily an indicator of future returns.